the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with the dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, I can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest possible chance of finding that perfect candidate. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 300,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
President Obama apologized to the families of two hostages killed in a drone strike aimed at Al-Qaeda. But in addition, he revealed two U.S. citizens who were part of Al-Qaeda were also killed. We'll analyze that with CBS's David Martin. Later, how do the Clintons make and raise money? That's in the spotlight largely because of a book coming out next month. And you'll hear CBS's Holly Williams, part of our coverage of the refugee crisis in southern Europe. Hundreds coming from Libya drowned this past week.
One survivor told Italian officials that human smugglers had crammed their 70-foot vessel with more than 900 people before it capsized.
And a lot more coming up on this weekend roundup. But first, President Obama's unexpected apology and revelation that attacks aimed at Al-Qaeda mistakenly killed two Western men who'd been kidnapped by the terrorists, including one American. CBS News national security correspondent David Martin.
President Obama once promised that before the CIA launched a drone strike, it would know to a, quote, near certainty that no innocent civilians would be killed.
I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families.
Despite what the president said were hundreds of hours of surveillance of the Al-Qaeda compound, two very innocent aid workers, American Warren Weinstein and Italian Giovanni Loporto, were killed by a CIA drone strike in January. Intelligence analysts never detected any sign of the hostages, but did see evidence of a senior Al-Qaeda operative. That seemed to make it even more unlikely hostages were in the compound, since there were no previous cases in which hostages had been held in close proximity to Al-Qaeda leaders. Several days later, another drone strike killed another American, Adam Gadan, again, without the CIA realizing it. Gadan played a leading role in Al-Qaeda recruiting and propaganda videos.
The White House spokesman was asked if the president felt any regret for having unknowingly killed two Americans fighting for Al-Qaeda. He said, in a word, no.
One of those Americans had become a propagandist for Al-Qaeda, giving anti-U.S. speeches. With more on Adam Gadan, killed at age 36, CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy.
On dozens of internet videos, Adam Gadan threatened attacks on major U.S. cities, called 9/11 payback for American crimes, and encouraged Muslims in the West to kill Americans.
A single word of American protest shall be silenced by 1,000 Islamic bombs.
In 2006, he became the first American indicted for treason since the World War II era.
Back to the innocent victims, the family of Warren Weinstein in Rockville, Maryland, issued a statement that blamed Al-Qaeda for his kidnapping in Pakistan, but expressed disappointment that the U.S. didn't do enough to help hostage families or try to make a deal. More from CBS News national correspondent Wyatt Andrews.
Weinstein was taken from his home in Lahore, Pakistan, in August of 2011, when armed men made their way past his security guards. He'd been living in Pakistan for 7 years, working as a government contractor.
I'm an American citizen. I've worked in public service for the U.S. government, and I would hope that my country will now look after me.
And was abducted just 4 days before he planned to return to the U.S.
Please do whatever you can.
During his 3.5-year captivity, his wife Elaine and their two daughters, Elisa and Jennifer, publicly pleaded for his release. Last year, Elaine expressed anger when her husband was not included in the deal that traded Sergeant Bo Bergdahl for 5 Taliban captives.
Let's follow up with CBS's David Martin at the Pentagon. President Obama apologized, so this was clearly a failure, a mistake?
Well, yes. They mistakenly killed 2 hostages, one of them an American. And this despite a promise that President Obama made at a major speech in which he said that before a drone strike can be launched, there must be, his words, near certainty that no innocent civilians would be killed.
Do officials explain why this news was released, coupled with news that Adam Gadan, the American who'd become an al-Qaeda spokesman, was killed? I mean, that was a separate strike. Why were they announced together?
Well, it was a separate strike, but I think it fell in the same category of an unexpected result. They did not realize that they were targeting Adam Gadan. And, of course, targeting an American citizen, even one who has gone over to the other side, is a very controversial act to take. And, in fact, requires prior approval from the Attorney General. And since the CIA had no idea that Adam Gadan was there, this got no prior approval from the Attorney General.
Should we be surprised by the apparent transparency here?
They were certainly going to have to explain how these hostages were killed. They obviously owed the families an explanation. And once they told the families would have every right to tell anybody they wanted to. So I think they decided that they had no choice but to admit to the mistake.
Intelligence analysts call this kind of attack a signature strike, where the CIA or the U.S. military doesn't know who exactly might be at an al-Qaeda or ISIS base, but a decision is made to hit the compound. Do you think the CIA will cut back on these kind of attacks?
That kind of signature strike was the most controversial of the drone strikes, and certainly now it is only going to become more controversial, and you just have to believe that the CIA is going to become more cautious.
CBS's David Martin. Now, the continued humiliation of David Petraeus, who as a general in Afghanistan and Iraq was considered a strategic genius, then became head of the Central Intelligence Agency until he admitted having an affair and sharing secrets with the woman writing his biography.
I'm Jim Crisula in Charlotte. Former CIA director and retired 4-star General David Petraeus spoke to reporters after pleading guilty to improperly having classified material.
I now look forward to moving on with the next phase of my life and to continuing to serve our great nation as a private citizen.
Petraeus was sentenced to 2 years probation and fined $100,000 for passing the information to a woman who became his biographer and mistress. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
2 major brands of ice cream announced total recalls because of contamination by Listeria. First Bluebell, then Jenny's. Correspondent Peter King.
The FDA says it doesn't believe the Jenny's recall is related to the Bluebell ice cream recall. Jenny's says it's working with suppliers to see if the bacteria came from one of its ice cream's ingredients. Bluebell ice cream has already been linked to 10 illnesses in 4 states. 3 deaths. The CDC says there are no known illnesses linked to the Jenny's recall. These recalls are unusual. Listeria is rarely found in ice cream because it can't grow in freezing temperatures.
It could be just a few days until factories are fully cleaned and fresh ice cream back on the market. Up next, the mysterious death of a man in police custody in Baltimore.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
Tension was high all week in parts of Baltimore. The mayor and the heads of the police department said they didn't know why and how a man who had just been arrested suffered a severe spinal injury, had to be hospitalized, and within days, he was dead. Freddie Gray was 25 years old, not charged with any crime. Police said they arrested him on what they called reasonable suspicion because he was running away from them. Crowds of angry citizens confronted police. This, for instance, Thursday night.
Emotions are running high and it's understandable. I think this is good. The people should do this.
More than one civil rights leader said, is it illegal to be running while black? And did the police beat Freddie Gray, lean on his spinal cord, or fail to lock his seatbelt after dragging him into a police van that transports prisoners? CBS News correspondent Chip Reed reported on Wednesday.
Another mass protest in Baltimore. It's become a daily ritual. Police Commissioner Anthony Batts, in the job since 2012, has publicly vowed to end Baltimore's history of police misconduct. He told CBS station WJZ that the department's intentions were good, but sometimes officers have gone too far.
To an extent, we're responsible for the pain in this community. Where we thought we were doing God's work, where we're going out trying to make communities safer, we've made mass arrests. We've locked people up. We've taken people to jail in numbers. And we've obliterated this community. And so we have to own that.
But Gene Ryan, the head of Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police, today launched a spirited defense of the officers and in a statement likened the protesters to a lynch mob.
When you're trying to put somebody in jail before all the facts are in, the investigation hasn't been completed, I mean, that's wrong.
That from Chip Reed in Baltimore. Now to Boston, where CBS's Don Daler had the unpleasant experience of seeing what the jury was seeing in the penalty phase of the trial of Johar Tsarnaev. The jury has to decide if the Boston Marathon bomber will get the death penalty. Prosecution witnesses were mostly survivors wounded for life.
Prosecutors played surveillance video over a new audio recording taken from a cell phone showing the shock and horror of that day.
Oh, my God! Something blew up. Oh, my God. Something happened. Holy s***.
When the second bomb exploded, Steve Wolfenden thought he was still standing. He tried to escape with his then 3-year-old son, whose head was bleeding. But Wolfenden realized he couldn't. I looked down and saw my leg sticking out of my boot, but it was no longer connected to my body. To his right, Denise Richard was crouched over her 8-year-old son, Martin. Moments before, Johar Tsarnaev had been lurking just feet away. Wolfenden testified, "I saw Martin's face and I could see a boy that looked like he was fatally injured. I could hear, 'Please,' and 'Martin.' She was pleading with her son." Dr. David King told the court the boy would have been in extreme pain. "I can say with an extraordinarily high degree of medical certainty that he did not die instantaneously." Mark Fucarillo lost a leg and still has dozens of BBs and shrapnel embedded in his body 2 years later. After nearly 70 surgeries, doctors are fighting to save his other leg. But he testified he'll likely lose that one, too.
This coming week, Tsarnaev's attorneys will try to save his life. Loretta Lynch, a federal prosecutor in New York City, is being sworn in as attorney general this coming Monday, confirmed 56-43 by the U.S. Senate. Watched by CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
She'll be the first African-American woman to serve as America's top law enforcement official.
On this vote,
members of the Congressional Black Caucus came over from the House to watch senators vote.
The nomination is confirmed.
The expression of emotion was a rare breach of decorum on the staid Senate floor. New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer.
She will make an outstanding attorney general. I believe every member of this body will be proud of her.
Let's follow up with our congressional correspondent, Stephen Portnoy. The vote was far from unanimous, but just the fact that Loretta Lynch has been confirmed, does that mean bipartisanship is breaking out?
Well, it might be another example of it, Dan, and the vote itself was bipartisan. 10 Republicans, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, joining with Democrats to confirm Loretta Lynch. McConnell was mobbed by members of the Congressional Black Caucus immediately after the vote to thank him for casting his vote in favor of the first African-American female attorney general. And it was only the result of a bipartisan compromise the day before on a sex trafficking bill stalled for more than a month over Democratic objections to abortion language in the bill. That deal was finally worked out this past week.
So that legislation, I imagine, was slightly changed, and the result there was a totally bipartisan vote.
It was 98-0 to send the sex trafficking bill onto the House and eventually onto the president's desk. A lot of Democrats and some Republicans were chagrined that it took more than a month to result in a unanimous agreement. But Democrats say that they held the line to prevent the expansion of what's called the Hyde Amendment, which is longstanding language in federal legislation that bans taxpayer funding of abortions.
Stephen, you're there at the Capitol every day. A lot of Americans may not realize that the way Congress is behaving now isn't really the same as 2 years and 4 years ago.
There was a new report, Dan, this week by the Bipartisan Policy Center that took a look for the first time at the productivity of Congress. They're calling it the Healthy Congress Index. What they have found is that in the first 3 months of the 114th Congress, that this Congress, under Republican control of the House and Senate, is meeting more than the past two Congresses. There were more sessions, and they're also finding that there is a sharp uptick in the number of amendments being voted on in the Senate. That is an example of a new kind of leadership that the Republicans are trying to offer. They say that they're going to offer the minority Democrats more opportunities to amend bills than they were allowed when Democrats controlled the Congress.
At the Capitol, that's CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet, Dan.
A new book by a Republican researcher has sparked questions about foreign contributions to the Clinton Foundation, some made while she was Secretary of State, so maybe they were intended to sway U.S. government decisions. The book's title is Clinton Cash. It's a history of how Bill and Hillary Clinton got rich. The author is Peter Schweitzer. Our report is by CBS News correspondent Juliana Goldman.
According to a copy obtained by CBS News, Schweitzer implies a potential quid pro quo regarding U.S. assistance to Nigeria. Former President Bill Clinton was paid $1.4 million by a Nigerian news media group to give two speeches there while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. It also raises new questions about longtime friend and major benefactor, Canadian billionaire Frank Giustra, including the implication that Secretary Clinton supported the Colombia Free Trade Agreement because it helped Giustra's business interests. In another example, the New York Times reported on a previously undisclosed donation of $2.35 million to the foundation from the owner of a Russian uranium mining company looking to operate in the U.S. That required approval by the State Department, among other agencies. Campaign Press Secretary Brian Fallon pushed back. In one memo, he specifically targeted the New York Times story, and he sent a three-page memo to Clinton supporters calling the book a smear project.
Coming up, refugees literally dying to get to Europe. It's a crisis.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Remember the days when we used to make macaroni art for mom or re-gift items found around the house for Mother's Day? This year, show mom how much you appreciate her and all that she does with flowers from Pro Flowers. Pro Flowers is offering listeners 100 blooms with a free glass vase for just $19.99. Or make her day extra special, upgrade to a premium vase, and add chocolates for just $9.99 more. Go to proflowers.com today and use the code ROUNDUP. Their easy-to-use website makes buying a beautiful gift for your mom simple and quick. Pro Flowers are guaranteed to be fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days. You just choose the delivery date you want, and it's guaranteed. Here's the only way to get 100 blooms with a free glass vase for just $19.99. Visit proflowers.com, click the blue microphone in the top right corner, and type in Roundup. That's proflowers.com, click on the microphone, and type in Roundup. Order today. This offer expires Friday at midnight.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
Now a CBS News investigation. A man from Colombia threatened with deportation to his home country in South America because he's retiring, you might say, as a secret informant for the U.S. government. Carlos Toro, who used many fake names and passports as part of his undercover work for the Drug Enforcement Administration, complains that the DEA is not protecting him. Being back in Colombia would not be just unpleasant, it could greatly increase Toro's chance of being murdered. Here's our national correspondent, Wyatt Andrews.
So this is your Peruvian ID.
Yes, this is your Colombian
passport.
For 27 years, Carlos Toro assumed many false identities as an undercover operative for the Drug Enforcement Administration. The intelligence he gathered helped in the prosecution of cocaine kingpin Carlos Leder of the Medellin cartel and Manuel Noriega, the former dictator of Panama. But at 66 years old and in declining health, Toro wants to quit. He says the DEA agreed, but has reneged on a promise to help him legally stay in the United States. Without legal status, he faces deportation back to his native Colombia.
I was loyal to them. I worked for them. I risked my life for them. And this is how they pay me. The United States government is sentencing me to death.
That's because in the 1980s, Toro was a high-ranking member of the cartel.
My job was to meet with heads of state, with the president of Nicaragua, with the president of Panama, with members of the Cuban government, and convince them to let us land in certain airstrips so we could make the second leg of the trip to the United States.
After Toro got arrested for cocaine trafficking, he turned informant and became one of the DEA's most important undercover assets around the world.
You could be the street drug dealer,
yes.
The street thug,
right.
Or you could be the banker.
Or I can be the banker or the diplomat.
Did you find it fun?
Yes, I found it fun.
He could walk the walk and talk the talk.
The man most upset about Toro's treatment is retired DEA agent Mike McManus, who was Toro's handler for 2 years.
It's not that often that you have a confidential source who can work undercover for nearly 27 years all over the world and still maintain a cover.
Is this a man who risked his life for the DEA?
Absolutely.
The DEA would not comment for this story, but McManus is urging the government to recognize Toro's contribution.
It is government bureaucracy at its worst. He deserves to live life ever after in the United States. He's paid his dues. He's done his service.
The 27 years of service, and I have to beg, and I put my life on the line for them.
With his visa now expired, Toro is asking for the government's help getting a green card or a passport. Without either of those documents, he can't even collect the Social Security benefits that he earned during the years he worked in the U.S.
That from CBS's Wyatt Andrews. Hundreds of people are drowning every week as they try to get to Europe for relative prosperity and safety because they're fleeing from Syria, Libya, and other Middle Eastern or African countries. CBS's Holly Williams reported this past Monday from southern Italy.
The Italian Coast Guard is still scouring the Mediterranean Sea for survivors off the coast of Libya. But many here fear they'll only find more bodies. One survivor told Italian officials that human smugglers had crammed their 70-foot vessel with more than 900 people before it capsized. Yet many others are ready to take the same risk. We found Gele Adan sleeping on the street in this small Italian city. He told us he and his friends arrived here a week ago after making the crossing from North Africa in a 15-foot boat, packed with more than 200 people. It took 3 days and 18 people died of asphyxiation in the hold, he told us. I prayed to God to save us. He said he paid $7,000 to the smugglers to get him out of Somalia after Islamic extremists killed several of his family members. I was prepared for death, he told us. And I was willing to take the gamble.
From Italy, now to the political center of Western Europe, Brussels, Belgium. CBS News reporter Terry Schultz on an emergency summit of European leaders.
The migration crisis has consumed Europe as the rows of coffins expanded and burned into the consciousness of leaders long accused of not doing enough to help hundreds of men, women, and children who drowned trying to find a better life. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, clearly shaken by the scale of the tragedy, urged her fellow leaders to find courage to deal with the problem, saying she was responding as a human and a mother to the plight of the migrants.
Sometimes being a politician is not easy because the message of send them back comes first. But then send them back is another way of killing them. And I hope that today is the turning point in the European conscience not to go back to promises without actions.
EU Council President Donald Tusk was moved too, convening heads of state and government for an emergency summit Thursday.
It cannot continue like this. We cannot accept that hundreds of people die when trying to cross the sea to Europe.
But human rights advocates say that's exactly what will continue to happen with the decisions taken Thursday. Leaders agreed to triple the funding and boost the resources allocated to their small naval mission off the coast of Italy, but the primary function will still be border control, not search and rescue. Nor would leaders agree to accept even as few as 5,000 migrants spread across the 28 countries. They are considering a military mission to destroy smugglers' boats so people can't set sail in the first place. Amnesty International's Ivana McGowan says these measures fail to fulfill the EU's humanitarian responsibilities.
Even though the death toll is spiraling, people still got on those boats.
What does that tell us about what's pushing them, the state of desperation and need for protection?
Amnesty says despite promising signs the EU would have a change of heart and policy, this plan is about leaders saving face, not saving lives. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
That's one of the subjects this Sunday on CBS's 60 Minutes. Clarissa Ward spoke about her report with Charlie Rose and Nora O'Donnell on CBS This Morning.
Already in the first 4 months of this year, an estimated 2,000 people have died trying to make this crossing across the Mediterranean, leaving their homes with the hopes of a better future in Europe.
Are they aware of the risk?
What's so shocking, Charlie, is that they do seem to be aware of the risk, but they don't seem to be deterred by it. We interviewed a Syrian family in Turkey who were hoping to cross to Italy, who ultimately went to Greece. And I said to them, are you not concerned as a father to make this choice to take your family on this boat? And he said, listen, there's a chance we could die on the way to Europe, but staying in Syria means certain death.
But that often doesn't work out, and would-be refugees die. Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm at Dan Revive.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revive.
The two largest cable TV operators were planning to merge, but Comcast now says forget about it, walking away from a $45 billion deal with Time Warner Cable. The federal government had clearly signaled it might sue to block the merger for the sake of protecting consumers, because the combined corporation would have controlled almost 60% of the broadband internet market and almost 30% of TV service that Americans pay for. Comcast is still big. It owns, for instance, NBC Universal. At the Justice Department, CBS News reporter Paula Reed.
Comcast's decision to drop a proposed acquisition of Time Warner Cable was hailed as a victory by outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder. In a statement, he said the decision was the best outcome for American consumers and providers of content and streaming services. The Justice Department had been reviewing the proposed acquisition and told the companies it had significant concerns.
At the Federal Communications Commission, the head of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, says the demise of the deal is in the best interests of consumers. He says a giant merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable would have posed an unacceptable risk to competition and innovation. The choices we have from cable TV, Verizon Fios, and satellite or dish are changing in terms of new opportunities to buy smaller packages of channels. You can use the internet or a box such as Apple TV, Roku, or Google's Chromecast to pay each month, for instance, just for HBO. On the CBS News nonstop digital service CBSN, Jeff Glor spoke with Joe Levy, editor-at-large at Billboard, about how Americans are getting the news and entertainment they care about. It's not just TV.
I begin my day on Twitter.
On your phone?
Twitter mobile. On my phone or on my iPad, I'm flipping through my feed looking for news stories that excite me, that spark my interest. Yeah. I'll click on those links, I'll read those, and I might stay on those sites and read something else. And that's a great way to start the day for me, but I'm an atypical consumer. I get content delivered to my inbox on my Gmail. I look at digests from three different companies, and that's literally how I start my day. And then sometimes I turn on the television and watch the news. But most people are going to start their day looking at Facebook, looking at what their friends are sharing. The content they're going to see, they're not actively seeking it out the way I might be. They're just going to see what's filtering up through Facebook. What a friend has passed to a friend has passed to a friend. More and more, you're going to see media companies who have their content exist inside of Facebook rather than outside.
Right, which Facebook certainly wants.
That's exactly right.
Big time.
Young consumers, millennials, want to watch content when they want to watch it, where they want to watch it. They don't necessarily want to have cable television. They don't want to have a lot of channels they're not interested in. They want things unbundled. And the truth is, except for live sports or live entertainment events, you can get almost anything you want. Sometimes for free, not always legally, when you want to see it.
So some unbundling takes place, likely, but it's not a full-on a la carte offering.
I don't know. I think we're heading more towards an a la carte offering. It's why I think you're going to see media companies do exactly what Netflix has done. Netflix basically became the new HBO when they actually got people excited about Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. And HBO has to become the new Netflix. They have to push their app out so that you can buy it separately, you can pay them separately, and you don't have to pay a cable carrier, who shall remain nameless for this discussion, several hundred dollars in order to access a small amount of content that you want, a couple of hours that you're interested in. People have really grown up in this iTunes era, being able to find what they want when they want it. If they want to pay for a television show, they believe they should be able to go to iTunes and buy it. And you also talk to people whose children walk up to the TV and touch it like an iPad, you know, try to move the image. Because, again, yes, that's where the brain is being rewired. That's where that idea of a new way of consuming and communicating comes into play. This is what people expect.
Joe Levy of Billboard magazine speaking on CBSN with Jeff Glor. A federal judge has approved an out-of-court settlement between the NFL and football players, potentially thousands who were planning to file lawsuits over concussions they suffered. CBS's Steve Futterman reported.
A key part of this deal for the NFL is that the league is not being forced to accept liability, and players who receive money must prove that their injuries were directly the result of playing in the NFL. But there is no doubt when you're talking up to $1 billion in payouts, this is a landmark case. The federal judge who approved the deal calls it fair, reasonable, and adequate.
The average individual award figures to be around $190,000. On the CBS Evening News, Scott Pelley talked about this with James Brown, the host of the NFL Today on CBS.
This deal could cost the NFL upwards of $1 billion.
What do you think some of the problems are that lie ahead?
We know Judge Brody has determined that payments will not be made until all appeals are resolved. Not every player is satisfied with this. So, Scott, it could be months or years until suffering retired players receive their money.
James Brown of CBS News and CBS Sports. On another subject, our correspondent Peter King has interviewed a New York Times sports writer, Bill Pennington, about his new book. It's called Billy Martin, Baseball's Flawed Genius. Martin was a second baseman, later a manager, most famously with the Yankees. He died at age 61 in 1989.
I want to go to the phrase Billy Ball, which started with him as a minor league manager in Denver.
He right away imposes this attacking style where they steal bases and they squeeze bunt like crazy and they hit and run and they take extra bases and they just salted the rest of the league.
He made it clear that he was not going to tolerate losing, that he hated losing.
After a tough loss, he'd look at the players starting to eat or lining up at the buffet and he'd just completely lose it and go grab the table and flip it over and, you know, send fried chicken flying all over the place. And then he'd start screaming at everybody, like, how can you eat? How can you eat? We just lost. This is how you end up being a loser.
Bill Pennington, author of Billy Martin, Baseball's Flawed Genius, interviewed by CBS's Peter King. Our weekend roundup commentator Charles Grodin is a big fan, not of the Yankees, but of the New York Mets. Those two teams are playing each other this weekend. Watching a game prompted this anecdote about medical second opinions.
As I watched the New York Mets on television, there are large signs for the Hospital for Special Surgery in the background. It was over three decades ago that an ambulance took me from my apartment to the Hospital for Special Surgery. I needed an ambulance because I not only couldn't walk, I couldn't move. That's because I trusted a very demanding trainer, who it turns out didn't know what he was doing. When I got to the hospital, it was quickly determined that I needed surgery. As I was being wheeled down the hall for the surgery, even though I was heavily drugged, I managed to say I haven't agreed to surgery. They wheeled me back to my room. The doctor came in and said, I understand you don't feel you need surgery. I muttered that the traction I was in was taking the pressure off my discs. The doctor, a nice man, suppressed his real feelings and kindly said, well, let's have a look. He then took my leg and bent it back toward my chest. I'll never forget the look on his face when I didn't say stop when he thought I would. He then said, well, I can always be wrong. I never had surgery. The traction worked, and thankfully I have not had any back pain since. The moral of this story is anyone can be wrong, and when it comes to your body, always be cautious about anything of significance. I'm Charles Grodin with the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
We wish Charles Grodin a happy birthday. He just turned 80. Up next, a newborn didn't survive, but other patients did.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Do you want to learn how to earn commissions of up to 20% by laundering millions of foreign dollars?
Well, we can't help you with that.
But among the many IT problems we solve, Barracuda's email security solutions keep email phishing attacks like this from entering your business network and any valuable data from leaking out. Reclaim your network like 150,000 other businesses have. To learn more about stopping email-borne threats, visit barracuda.com/email.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Now a bittersweet story from Great Britain. A baby did not survive, but thanks to transplants, some good has been done. CBS News reporter Larry Miller has that.
A newborn baby who lived less than 2 hours is Britain's youngest ever organ donor. Jess Evans and Mike Holston knew their baby was not going to survive a genetic condition and decided his organ should be donated to help others. Specialist nurse Angarai Griffiths was there.
He passed away very, very peacefully in his mum's arms, and that's when I took Teddy from mum and took him to the operating theatre.
Teddy's kidneys saved the life of one patient. His heart valves went to another. Teddy's father, Mike, describes him as a hero. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Now to northern Germany. A former Nazi concentration camp guard has gone on trial for involvement with hundreds of thousands of murders. He's 93. He says he was only keeping records at the Auschwitz death camp. CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips reports from Lüneburg, and you'll hear parts of some documentaries about the Holocaust.
Today, Oskar Gröning is a 93-year-old man with a dark past that has finally caught up with him. In the war, he was a member of the Nazi SS assigned to Auschwitz. Today, Hedy Baum is an 86-year-old woman who is finally getting her day in court. During the war, she was a Jewish teenager deported to Auschwitz, where both her parents were murdered. Now, in a German court, fate has brought Oskar Gröning and Hedy Baum together again. He accused as an accessory to 300,000 murders.
Men and women condemned to death.
She as a witness to his crimes.
I cried after my mom, and she heard me, turned around.
Hedy was one of more than 400,000 Hungarian Jews deported to Auschwitz in 1944, and one of the small percentage chosen for work. Her parents were not.
We just looked at each other, and she didn't say a word. Then I saw her turn and walk away. And I was ordered to go to the right, and I never saw her again.
Oskar Gröning was not one of those who decided who would die and who might live. His job was to confiscate the victim's valuables. He was death's bookkeeper, a cog in the machine, he says. But those who have pushed for this trial say without cogs, machines don't run.
Nazi guilt goes deeper than suspected.
In the past, German justice has been content to charge only those directly involved in the killing. And when he arrived at the court, Gröning said he expected to be found not guilty. But Thomas Walter, the retired German judge who built this case, thinks many were let off too easily.
Has this been a failure of the German justice system, do you think, over the course of the last 40 years?
You know the answer. 60. Yes. Yes, it's no question.
That the justice system has failed?
Yes, it's no question. I can only say yes, yes. It's a big, big failure.
There's an irony in this trial. The defendant has never denied that he was part of the Nazis' final solution, but he has denied his guilt. That self-serving fiction is what will now be tested at this trial.
That from CBS's Mark Phillips in Germany. For reaction, I turn to the founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, Rabbi Marvin Heyer. I asked if it's fair to put a 93-year-old on trial.
He's competent enough, as you can see, to answer the most complex questions that will be put to him. So that's a non-starter that he's 93 years old. And when they were operating Auschwitz, they didn't care if someone was an infant was 6 months or 7 months. They went to the crematoria. So I have no sympathy for someone who's going to claim that he's 93 years old. None of his victims lived to 93 years old.
Of course, he also says that he did not personally kill anybody.
Well, first let me say this, that guards at Auschwitz, if you look at the history of Auschwitz, Treblinka, Majdanek trials, you will find that almost anyone that is caught and put on the stand always seeks a defense like they were a short order chef in the kitchen. Yes, they were there. They were either doing accounting, they were serving breakfast, and they had nothing to do with the crimes. If you're a guard, if you were assigned to Auschwitz, you are complicit in those crimes. And there's no doubt about that.
Rabbi Marvin Heyer, dean and founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center with the Museum of Tolerance, that's in Los Angeles. Thank you, Rabbi Heyer. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now to a project that aims to train journalists to cover the world in this digital age. You can see the results so far, photos, video, and blog posts about Afghanistan at a website, thegroundtruthproject.org. The founder is former Boston Globe newsman Charles Sennett.
The Ground Truth Project is an old school principle, one that CBS knows well, and one that CBS really set the standard for from Edward R. Murrow going forward, which is you have to be there. Mm-hmm. You have to be on the ground. I will never forget hearing Edward R. Murrow recording the footsteps of children going into a bomb shelter in World War II in London and wanting to work in radio, mm-hmm. and thinking the power of being there is what it is all about in great journalism. Not proclaiming one truth. We don't want ground truth to sound arrogant. Ground truth is about many truths, trying to get at all sides of a story. But it's also about recognizing that among the hierarchy of truths, the ones that come from being there, not a cubicle, not academia, not an opinion, but just from being witness to what's going on, are the most important and where you get the best reporting.
Charlie Sennett, do you fear or are you in fact convinced that old line media outlets like mine, CBS News, can't do this or decided not to do this? I mean, why do we need you?
Look, every Sunday, my family and I have four boys who are teenagers. Every Sunday, we gather to watch 60 Minutes. It's great journalism. I don't think CBS is going anywhere. I think CBS is just changing, as we all are. It's going to be a rocky transition, though, because the revenues are not there the way they used to be in the commercial model to produce in-depth journalism. We're going to have to find new ways. We're never going to be able to go fully nonprofit and only put our hand out. We're going to have to mix revenue streams. But what we've found is if your mission is great journalism, the outlets to put it out there are available, and you can have great reach, great audience impact, because I think we all as journalists want to go out and change the world. Our goal at Ground Truth is to say we're going to take a millennial generation, and we're going to work with them to cover the biggest issues of the day that will impact them and bring their voice to that coverage. That's not any different, really, than the New York Times or the CBS News or the other great news organizations. But we don't want to give up on the old school values. We want to be digital age, but we want to be old school as well.
And the website is thegroundtruthproject.org. Charles Sennett, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.